All right, well, if you have your Bibles, go ahead and open them up to Genesis chapter 7. We are slowly but surely pressing onward. Now, I think I said last week, and then I know for sure I did put in the weekly newsletter this week that what we would be covering was how the Nephilim returned. However, we will not be covering that. As you see on your handout, there's a few other things that I think are pretty significant to cover before we do that. So we're going to be dealing with how the Nephilim returned after the flood next week. We're going to be majoring on that next week. This week, we've got all the stuff on the handout. Does anybody not have a handout that would like one? All right. So this stuff is all important. Today, what we're going to do is kind of major on the flood. We're going to talk about what happened during the flood, as a result of the flood, all that kind of stuff. So last week, we kind of ended with a summary. We kind of summarized and recapped the situation. I think that'd be a good place to start, because we kind of wrapped up the days of Noah, if you will, characterizing those days last week. And we had about seven kind of points, if you will, that kind of summarized the situation. So just fire away. What was going on then? What were those days known for? What have we covered the last few weeks about the days of Noah? Let's summarize before we get going. Fallen angels. Give me more. Okay. Fallen angels were corrupting the gene pool. Noah and his family were the only ones left who were uncorrupted. What does that mean? How was the gene pool being corrupted? Okay. So they were creating a whole new species, whole new breed that was taken over. Okay. What else was going on? Total depravity in a unique way. What does that even mean?
The Nephilim that were the result of the offspring of Nephilim were bent even more towards worse wickedness and evil than just fallen mankind.
They say that again. They had a...
They were even more evil, more violent. They were
more depraved. Mm-hmm. So last week we kind of majored on this unique, what we called unique depravity that we saw in the Nephilim, and then we saw a variety of ways that that manifested itself and played out. Anything else? Corruption of the animal kingdom. All right, yeah. Where did we get that? There was two words that kind of began to lead us in that direction. All. That would be right, but that's more than two words. He said, all that have breath, which is right. All flesh. Very good. We did not talk about bestiality, but there's nothing that implies that it was going on, but I guess we can't rule it out, but I'm not going to suggest that it was, since we don't have anything about it. But there was genetic DNA corruption going on within the animal kingdom, like Charlie said, which was creating weird half-breeds and all kinds of stuff that was not normal. It was everything from the animal kingdom to humans was this backwards corruption of God's ordained order of things, each according to its kind, each according to its kind, each according to its kind, 10 times over again. And then you get this crossbreeding and havoc that resulted. Anything else? Extreme violence. Yes, absolutely. And that kind of ties in with what Tammy was saying about their unique bend to that sort of thing. They had an inherent greater, if you will, bend toward wickedness and depravity. Just out of curiosity, raise your hand if you're new here this week. 1, 2, 3. Wow, you picked a week to come. That's for sure. All right. Well, for y'all's benefit and those online, I'm going to summarize what we've just talked about in 7 short bullet points, and then we'll press on. I'm not going to answer all these questions because we've spent 6 weeks getting these 7 points, and so I encourage you to go listen online. We have been recording this online right here for me, so we can't hear all of you very well, but you can hear the teaching well. We're uploading that on the website usually by Wednesday night every week. All right, so the days of Noah were unimaginably wicked. We talked about this last week, and here's 7 things that we've covered in the last 2 weeks that characterize the increasingly depraved scenario on the earth, beginning all the way, if you remember, all the way back in the days of Adam through the days of Noah up until the time of the flood. That's the time frame here. So number one, no particular order here. Fallen angels were actively engaging and dealing with humans in the earth overtly, clearly, and freely. Number two, several of these fallen angels had sexual and marital relations with human women, creating an entirely new species called the Nephilim. Number three, the Nephilim were half angelic, half human beings who were giants. They were insanely tall, perhaps many dozens of feet tall, incredibly strong, brilliantly intelligent, and unimaginably depraved. We reiterated last week that the giants were not just big humans, they are semi-celestial giants. They are half angel. Number four, the gene pool was almost entirely wiped out. All people left at the time of the flood except for Noah and his family possessed the Nephilim gene and were damned. Number five, we talked about how close God cut it. Number five, the genetic perversions and manipulations did not stop with humanity, but they included the entire animal kingdom with forbidden crossbreeding between species, among other corruptions. Number six, extreme violence, as Karen said, including perhaps cannibalism and satanic rituals and sinfulness, characterized the times. Lastly, number seven, we didn't spend much time here because we just don't have time. But we briefly touched on there was likely a one-world government or empire, for lack of better words, that functioned under the rule of fallen angels, the Assyrian in particular, being one of the most powerful angel at the time, aside from Satan. And then we know while Satan was not, we know that he created serious, significant, I mean major mayhem. The world came this close to, or at least humanity rather, came this close, and the world for that matter, to not making it, to not surviving. And so he created significant mayhem through all this, but they were not 100% successful in achieving their goals of contaminating the bloodline of all mankind. At the last possible moment, Noah and his family are taken aboard the ark and saved from the deluge that wipes out everything. Both the deluge of genetic tampering and the deluge that God flooded the earth with. So that's kind of where we're at. That's what we've been covering, especially in recent weeks, kind of getting a feel for what were those days like. And the whole reason we're doing that, somebody tell me, why do we want to have a feel for what these days are like? Why are we digging into this stuff? How do you know that? I agree with you. She said because the end times will be like the days of Noah, and then Paul says because Jesus said so. Can anybody give me more specifics? Okay. What'll it be like? And he says, as in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. So there's some unique stuff that's going on in those days. It's going to be like that again in the end. We believe we're in, generally speaking, the end times, and fast approaching the end of the end times, namely lots of increase of everything. Revelation talks about things heating up and increasing in magnitude and frequency and on in those in the end. And so that's where we believe we're headed, but we're not date setters and we're not going to play that game. Just generally speaking, we believe we're towards the end. And so this is increasingly relevant to us now and more relevant to us every day and every week that goes by. So now I want to kind of, now that we've got a feel for what the days were like, and we've to get this kind of image of the Nephilim, we've gone forward into the Promised Land and looked at the giants that were there, and we've kind of unpacked them, and we've gone backwards and tried to get a feel for exactly what that looked like before the flood. And then the flood comes. And so in the ever-persistent battle, and if you look for it, if you look at the narrative throughout Scripture, you'll see this battle back and forth with God and Satan. And it's quite interesting. And in this ever-persistent battle, God responds with a worldwide flood that destroys everything. At least everything that draws breath. And even in that one sentence, there's two very important words that at times find disagreements and debates, namely worldwide and everything. So I want to look at both of those and see it in the Word, not just hear my perspective on it. So number one, the flood was worldwide. So this is going to be under kind of the great deluge on your handout, the flood toward the top. The flood was worldwide, namely it was a global flood. Now, if you've never read the account of the flood, please read it. It's Genesis 6 to 8. Do it for homework. We're not going to walk through verse by verse through the flood narrative. We are going to see bits and pieces that are relevant this morning. So the flood was global. Now, where do we get that in Scripture? Anybody know? The flood is global. Where do we get that in Scripture? Well, we get it from Genesis chapter 7. For those of you taking notes, you can write it down. Chapter 7, verses 17 to 20. And I will read it out loud for you all. Here's what it says. It says, "The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep." Now, it's fairly clear to us in English there, in English, that all the mountains under the whole heaven were covered. But the Hebrew is even more clear that what is meant here is describing a worldwide global flood, a global catastrophe, not a local one. Now, aside from that couple of verses, are there any other reasons for believing that this is a global event and not a local one? Richard. So there's geological evidence of catastrophic damage, if you will, done to the earth. Okay?
Was the whole earth inhabited by that time?
Was the whole earth inhabited? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was billions of people, likely. Upwards of, on the low end, hundreds of millions, to the high end, a little over 3 billion, somewhere in that range. So kind of somewhere between 1 and 3 billion. Go on.
Yeah, it said, "and all flesh died."
And all flesh died. All. Not some, right? Okay, absolutely. We're using logic here. I like it. Critical thinking. Youngins don't know how to do it these days. What else? Anything else? I got 4 or 5 reasons, and you've already covered half of them, which is great. There's a lot of reasons, lots of reasons for believing this. I'm not going to argue every point, but I am going to share just a few with you. And then if you want to talk about any of these in particular with me later, do that. The context of the flood account, this is something you would learn if you just read probably the intro to Genesis in your Bible, if you have a decent study Bible. The flood account in Genesis chapter 1 through 11, I'm not suggesting that the flood covers 11 chapters, I'm suggesting it's in Genesis 1 through 11, is on a, it's a question about universal origins. Genesis is broken up in chapters 1 through 11 and chapters 12 through 50. The first 11 chapters deal with origin and universal things. The flood, obviously creation, the existence for quite some time, antediluvian era, the flood, and then after the flood, and once we get a little bit of stuff, Tower of Babel, stuff like this we'll deal with soon. In fact, we'll touch on that next week. And then once we get to Genesis chapter 12, we hone in specifically on Abraham and his family, his lineage, and that's where we go the whole rest of the time. We don't go off and see all the other people groups of the world. And so in this context, in these first 11 chapters, it's a universal one. Likewise, just another reason, Jesus speaks of his future second coming, which will be worldwide, a worldwide global event, and he says that it will be like the days in the days of Noah. We've already covered this connection between the two, and he's making this connection between his worldwide second return and the worldwide days of Noah in the flood and the worldwide flood that wiped them all out. There's also some theological problems that arise, some of which we covered back when we discussed the age of the earth, issues concerning the timing of death and suffering, entering into creation, and more that I'm not going to rehash right now. But one of the things that we that I leaned toward was rather than a long period of time and natural processes, a shorter period of time with catastrophic, I don't even want to say just catastrophe. I don't want to say processes, just catastrophe, kind of what Richard was alluding to a minute ago. There's some other issues there, and if you want to pick my brain on that, I can share later. Furthermore, are there any scientific or just other logical reasons why it can't be a global flood? Or if it wasn't a global flood, if it was only a local flood, what are some questions that might come to mind? Yvonne danced all around it. Elaine? Okay. Okay. Again, so geological evidence of it. Yvonne? There would still be Nephilim. Okay. That's assuming they were in areas where the flood didn't hit. But even more broad than the Nephilim themselves, any other questions that might arise if we said this was a local flood? Okay, that's kind of what Yvonne was getting at earlier. It wouldn't have killed all flesh. Some flesh would have survived in the area. We also might would think, I mean, at least the way my brain thinks, I would be going, why on earth do we need a boat? Why do we need an ark? Why can't we just migrate over there? You know, God could have just said that's an area that's not going to be affected.
If it's totally flooded for 40 days and nights, yeah, you'd be a pretty good swimmer otherwise.
Right, right. No, if there's this flood that's going to be... No, I mean, it rained for 40 days and 4 nights, and the flood persisted for 150 days for 5 months. So, Richard.
I was thinking with geology, you have seashells.
Yes, yes, there's lots of sea life evidence, sea fossils, sea creature fossils, et cetera, on Everest and other mountains, not just Everest, in the Americas and elsewhere. Even if we try to play games with the moon, which does cause it to not be our Earth is not a perfect sphere. It's like a sphere that's been crunched down a little bit. It's wider, and we see the way the oceans function, the waves, and all this. And if the moon were to disappear, we'd all be flooded because the moon plays an integral role in waves and tidal currents and on. All right. I was going to talk about Mount Everest, but y'all have already covered it, so I don't need to go there. It seems to me that oftentimes, it doesn't just seem to me, I think it's evident, that scientists will try to explain that sort of thing away. They say, well, you know, there's fish fossils up here or whatever. And they'll say, ah, well, that that was something. They'll explain it a different way. One of the common ways they'll explain it away is they'll say, well, maybe that was from, even Christians sometimes will explain it away. They'll say, well, that was from when the before creation, essentially, when the whole earth was just a void of water. So it was back then. But that misses all kinds of things, namely, sea life didn't come into the picture until day five of creation, and the earth itself, so mountains weren't pulled up out of the deep until day three, and so that just didn't work. But of course, the world and scientists, not to diss or knock science, but the world, under the influence of Satan and his deception, will do anything to kind of go in a different direction. They tend to believe what is false because that's what Satan's leading them to do, and they scoff at those who believe the truth, which Peter certainly says is going to be true in the end days, and I think has a unique relevance to all this stuff. We're seeing all that kind of stuff now. We're seeing, I mean, male and female, gender, sex, I mean, and so much more is super relevant to our culture today. And if you believe in the kind of archaic truths of the Bible, I mean, it's laughable almost today, which is in a way encouraging because we see prophecy of Peter where he says, this is what's going to happen in the end days. We're seeing it happen before our eyes. And so we get an affirmation of the authenticity of the word. So I would say anytime science and the world are pushing a narrative that runs or seems to run contrary to the Bible, we just got to be real careful and we got to be very discerning. And I think this is the norm. That the world will push or lean toward falsehoods, things that are not true. So the bottom line here, there's more little things like that we could cover, but I don't think we need to right now. The bottom line here is that the flood was global. It was a global event, not a local event. And you could say, well, why is this so important, Brian? Why are you holding on to this? Why can't we just kind of whatever, kind of let each believe whatever they want? Because the authenticity of the Bible rests on this. This is not a minor issue. So if the Bible's wrong about this, well, why isn't the Bible wrong about the message of salvation, for example, or much more? So we got to stick to our guns when it comes to stuff that's clear in the Word. Okay, let's press on. There was two things I was looking at. One was that it was global, and the other one was that it wiped out everything that had breath, as Paul said. So all flesh, we talked about that extensively last week. All flesh, all flesh, all flesh. Everything except what? Two totally different answers in different directions. And I agree with both of them. But I didn't hear who. Somebody over here. Was it you? Okay, Noah and his family. So that which was on the ark. And then, and you said fish. Yeah, the creatures of the sea. Yes.
There had to be a bird.
Huh?
There had to be a bird.
A bird? There were birds saved. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so this point, whether or not the flood killed everything except that was on the ark, is less debated, but it tends to be argued by those who don't embrace the first point. And kind of like Yvonne was getting at, and I think Sandy as well, if the flood was only local, then everything else that dwells, everything that dwells on the earth, that word everything, all flesh, wouldn't have been destroyed. Only the things in the area of the local flood. And so again, now we're seeing these two points kind of tie together, and we create issues with the flood account if we don't embrace both. And if we say, okay, well, other than just saying all flesh or whatever, is there something that's a little more clear, a little more overt? Yes, there is. Anybody know where it is? It's the next three verses. So we did chapter 7, verses 17 to 20. Now chapter 7, verses 21 to 23. Lay eyes on it, because this is very, very clear. Here's what it says. Moses tells us this. He says, and all flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. And he keeps going. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground. like, we get it. Man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, they were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark. Was that clear enough? It's... Yeah, no, it's. I think it's super clear. It seems to me, at least, and I imagine we all feel the same way, that God is going out of his way to go above and beyond, to make absolutely certain that we really get it and that we have no doubt in our mind whatsoever. Everything on the earth was destroyed except for what he made provision for and saved through the ark. Birds.
Birds,
correct. There was nowhere to make it, and it lasted way too long.
Yep.
Yep. Very good. Yes. Yes. No, birds did not kind of hover around for a very long time. No. 40 days is not. That's just how long it. Yeah. That's just how long it rained. But then it stayed that way for 5 months, 150 days. Is there a question?
No, I'm just saying how long it stayed.
Yeah, for a lot of time. There's a lot of water. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Try to wrap our minds around it because it's incredible. So as Karen alluded to earlier, this does not include water-dwelling creatures. And a common... say it again, Ken? Your next question, yes. So a common scoffing or mocking from the world is that if it was a global flood, then the fresh water should have destroyed all the sea life, and the salt water should have destroyed all the freshwater creatures and organisms. However, despite not having the details that we want, we know that God must have somehow, in his own wisdom and according to his own ways, protected them. Now, exactly how he did this, we don't know. But we know that he did, with certainty. How do we know that? Because they're here today. We have saltwater creatures and we have freshwater creatures. They've continued to survive. And so he somehow, in some way that he doesn't see fit to tell us how, he protected them. And so the ark... Go ahead, Steve. Yes? Well, on the fifth day of creation, we... In the third day of creation, we get God separating the land from the water, from the seas. And then in the fifth day, we get the creation of the sea creatures, specifically the ocean-dwelling sea creatures and all that. So yeah, there was an ocean. We'll talk a little more on what that looked like in just a few minutes. Was there another question?
Having lived in Florida for half a century, not only water don't mix. You see places sharpen the body line in different bodies of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in different currents and such. But given the catastrophic nature of this, you could wonder why people might question, you know, having the whole earth completely full, which we're going to try to wrap our minds around again in a few minutes. It's such a catastrophic thing, not a really organized thing with neat little currents and stuff like this. I got two. Steve, go ahead. Say it again. Okay. Yes, so a lot of water was evaporated. Yeah, we're told in chapter 8, I believe, where he sends the wind and dries it up. We get evaporation. It goes up into the atmosphere. Most of the water did not go up. It went back down. Quentin? Or we need to know it. We just don't need to know how.
Right.
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 No, that's very good. We have on the website under position papers, some of you veterans would remember this from many years ago. We did this I think it was a couple of week series on the Hebrew mindset versus the Greek mindset, and we put these kind of ways of thought for both of them. And one of the issues with the Greek or the Western mindset as opposed to the Hebrew is that they're so academically focused that they cannot tolerate mystery. They must know, they must understand, they must see in full. They can't deal with missing little pieces. And so the academic Western mindset, which is what most of us were raised in and with and still contend with, has a real hard time with a lot of what's in here because this is not written that way. This is not as Bob has told us several times, this is not a textbook. It's not a science book. It's got things that God is trying to communicate to us, most chiefly and most important, the plan of salvation through Jesus Christ from start to finish, and lots of details that we wish were there are not, and we got to be okay with that. We got to be able to submit to that and tolerate ambiguity and tolerate mystery and on, like Quentin's suggesting. So very good. I was going to say that, did you have something or no? Okay. I was going to say the ark was not a massive aquarium. It was for land-dwelling animals. And then what was destroyed was everything, quote, everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life. Now just, how many of you remember reading about the hundreds of aquariums on the ark, and the thousands upon thousands of sea creatures and organisms that he got there, and how that came up out of the ocean and got on the ark? And you remember reading about all that stuff? No, you don't, because that didn't happen. This was land-dwelling creatures. More mystery and tolerance for ambiguity required. So this is going to be important as we get going, namely, next week when we talk about how the Nephilim returned after the flood. We need to grasp these two points, because I think it was Yvonne that said earlier, she mentioned about the Nephilim could have survived the flood if it was only a local flood, for example. But what we're told is that no flesh survived. The only flesh that survived was what was on the boat, what was on the ark with Noah, provided by God. No Nephilim survived the deluge. Like, they're really good swimmers. Edith, I think, was talking about. Like, they spent 5 months kind of doing this, kind of on their back. I mean, they were really strong and really capable, but they did not make it. God let it go long enough that they could not make it. Quentin. Yes, go. Right. Yeah, he provides the exception.
Correct.
And he did the same thing in chapters 6 and 7 when we were in that last week, if not the week before, I think it was last week, where we saw all flesh corrupted, but then here's some exceptions to that.
There's lots of things that look contradictory, but we just need to know that they're not.
Yeah.
Just because we can see it doesn't mean that it isn't.
Yeah, our ability to grasp God is finite. In his ways and so on. Absolutely, very good. So this is going to be important when we dig into how they came back, because we got to see that all flesh is destroyed here except for what's on the ark. So any questions up until this point? I want to, at this, after any questions, I want to look at the flood itself and some things that went on during the flood or as a result of the flood. No questions. Great. Well, very good. Everybody understanding? Everybody tracking well? Okay. All right. So what are some things that happened during the flood? I want to treat this kind of like the how we started with, where we just kind of threw out some answers, and then I'll go kind of point by point through about six, I think, with the rest of our time. What are some things that happened during or as a result of the flood? We've covered. They sent birds out. Yes, they did send birds out. But I mean, as a result, for example, here's the first one that I wrote down, and we've already covered this well. It destroyed all flesh. That was a result of the flood. That happened during the flood. All flesh was killed, drowned. What else? We touched Richard's. Richard's talked about something that happened during the flood. Geologically. The waters burst out of the deep. That gets into a whole kind of overarching point, would be something along the lines of catastrophe or catastrophic trauma experienced by the earth. We can come back to that in a second. Anything else?
And the floodgates of the heaven. This coming from both directions.
Mm-hmm. Spewing up from under and raining for the first time. Richard. I agree with that. Well, let's unpack that point a little further then, since we're all over that anyway. All the fountains, as Tammy said, of the deep burst forth. Now, I don't remember what verse this is. Somebody, if you want to read it, 7:11, and it says, why don't you read it? Okay, so this would be like, we've touched on this point before, back in week two, I think. This would, and I want us to try to wrap our minds around this situation, what's going on the planet at this time. It would be like every volcano on the planet erupting simultaneously, except exponentially more violent than volcanoes. Because when a volcano erupts, the volume of what's ejected out of it, the contents of what comes out of the volcano, are very small in comparison to this. Even the most devastating of scenarios with volcanoes do not even come close. They're not even a drop in the bucket comparatively. In other words, listen to the next three sentences. In other words, I'm going to explain. In other words, when volcanoes erupt, the earth is not filled with magma up to 15 cubits or 30 cubits, whatever it was, over Mount Everest. I mean, that would be unfathomable. The earth does not fill up with magma. However, when the subterranean fountains of the deep erupted and then continued to erupt, bursting forth through the very surface of the planet, erupting, breaking, busting, all this stuff that Richard was kind of getting at a few minutes ago. The entire earth was filled with water. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of feet. The volume, I don't even want to try to do math and come up with the volume of water that this would have been. It's simply unfathomable, at least to me. I cannot wrap my mind around it. Everest is nearly 30,000 feet tall. Boquete is 3,700 feet tall. So take nine more of what we got here. And it covered all that. And it wasn't just a local flood that kind of sort of covered this mountain. It covered the whole earth like this. This is an insane amount of water. That again, volcanoes, the comparison was that volcanoes, while they're very devastating, they don't do that. They don't leave that amount of magma, for example. And so this is planetary upheaval. I mean, this is utter catastrophe on the earth, on the planet, and it would have caused great earthquakes to shift and mountains to crumble and move and cities to be totally wiped out and devastated during this catastrophic trauma experienced by the earth. And then The devastation that this would do to the earth, because this, as we've already said, remained for 5 months. All this water was there, and it wasn't just still, it was moving through, and the incredible force under this, it's unparalleled by anything ever, including, I would say, the Great Tribulation, which is going to be terrible, but it's not going to be this. It's going to be a different terrible, not like this, specifically to the earth. We're going to see stuff burnt up. We're going to see asteroid impacts, but we're not going to see the entire earth full of this kind of volume and weight of the water doing this kind of damage to the earth. Eighteen inches, meaning it covered the top of the mountain by that much.
Yes. So the tops of the highest mountains were
not visible. Underwater, yeah. Yeah, times 1.5. So 23.5 feet.
That's
yes, that's the point I'm making. You've articulated it very well. Yes, yes, there is. Absolutely. Did you have something else? Yeah.
And so huge, because that's not even due to the circumference. All that water, a lot of it must have come from up, because the inside couldn't. The inside of the earth doesn't have enough water to take it that high, so the top and the bottom.
Well, it had to be both, yeah. But to be fair, the inside of the earth has quite a bit of water in it, but it rained. I mean, it poured down rain. I mean, you imagine the rain we experience here just over the whole earth for 40 days nonstop, day and night, plus all the stuff coming up from the deep. I mean, this was, like you're saying, and like I'm saying, unfathomable. I mean, I cannot even kind of going through it in these steps the way I'm trying to do to help us. I still can't wrap my mind around it, because there's nothing to compare it to. I mean, there's no analogy or illustration I can give that kind of helps us. Oh, that makes sense. There's nothing like that. There's never been anything like this, nor will there ever be anything like this again. Edith.
Well, the guts of the earth hold fresh water that we get from springs.
Mm-hmm.
Volcanoes, like you just said, which are hot lava.
Mm-hmm.
That's all in the center of the earth, and we don't understand that. So how are we going to understand the Lord?
Yeah. Oh, there's tons of mystery with creation. That is for sure. God is incredible and creative. Ken.
Didn't you mention last week that there was no rain before the flood?
Yes.
So the water that was on the earth, that was what sustained everybody already there.
Water that was on the earth, and there was this gentle mist that would water the earth, that would just come up from beneath, which we don't have now. We don't know what that was like. We can't really imagine that, but that's how it was then. So rain was just totally new, whole new concept. Yeah. Say it again.
To blow my mind even further, it couldn't have only happened for one place. If we've ever got a ball and we spray a thing on a ball, it goes in circles. So that means it couldn't have come from, had to come from everywhere similar to this, so the world wouldn't go spinning around.
I mean, it's not like, yeah, there was just a few clouds in the Panama area, and then the rest of the earth, it just kind of drained over the earth. It was raining on the whole earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Richard, and then Jim. Go ahead. No, you and then him.
Someone explained that the water above, they put the water fire in the above, it turned ice. So that water was always above us, and the earth was encapsulated by ice, which would make it a very active chamber, which would make the oxygen content much richer.
Yes, and it blocked out all kinds of UV rays and damaging stuff from the sun. Right. No, I agree with that. I'm not sure that it was ice, but it seems to be some kind of barrier, some kind of vapor, or something physically that was there that is not there anymore. And it has an effect on, like you said, the oxygen and the nitrogen content in the atmosphere, and played a significant role in lifespan of people and animals, for that matter, and dinosaurs. All right. Let's see. I feel like we've covered this well. This is just so hard to wrap our minds around. Richard already said, and I agree, that this is At this time, the earth was one big landmass, and this is when things broke apart and moved. Again, this is not a kind of incremental natural processes over the period of hundreds of millions or billions of years, but rather this is insane, catastrophic damage that made it all happen quickly. Not a little bit of damage over a long period of time, but a lot of bit of damage over a little bit of time. I saw some hands, Jim. Yeah, we're not sure what he did. We do know that things changed after the flood, though, and exactly how they changed, he doesn't tell us. So that goes back to the having to deal with not having the details that we wish we had in a lot of this kind of stuff. But things radically changed, and we know that lifespans drastically dropped off afterwards, and among other things. All right. Is what going to happen again? We're not told of any, I don't have any biblical answer for that, whether or not the continents are going to move again. There's tectonic plates that are moving, and yeah, is it going to be something, you're talking about pole shifts and all that kind of stuff? I don't even want to go there because it doesn't tell us specifically, so we would have to kind of say, well, maybe that's what this sort of thing in Revelation is referring to, and we would kind of have to inject it in there. But, you know, could there be devastation through pole shifts, for example? Yeah. Is there going to be devastation through all kinds of stuff in the end times? Yeah. I mean, it seems evident that there's going to be large asteroids and meteors and stuff like this. This is just going to wreak havoc on the earth, and then vegetation is going to get wiped out and on. Bob covered that really well back when we went through the end times Bible study. And, of course, God has promised that he will not destroy the world, the earth again, by water, but he will do it by fire in the end. So incredible devastation is coming again. It's just going to be different and look different. And certainly the end result is going to be glorious, not what it was here. Quentin.
That God would give them the symbol of the rainbow to assure them that it will never happen again.
Mm-hmm. And as we're going to see, I don't want to jump too far ahead, we're going to see, goodness, we got a long way to go for today. We're going to see that, I don't want to get too far ahead. We're going to see that the non-believers, people of the world under the influence of Satan and Nephilim, once they came back, they expected one, and they attempted to prepare for one, and we're gonna talk about that later, specifically how they prepared. And it's not speculation, it's a biblical account, so come back next week. We're going to touch on that. I think we're going to touch on that next week. It plays a part in how the Nephilim returned, and so that'll be... They expected another flood, and so they tried to defend themselves against one, prepare for one. They did specific things, and we'll talk about that next week. So we've covered two things that happened during the flood. I have six that I'd like to cover. I don't imagine we'll get all six, but maybe if we hurry. Number three, just of things that happened during the flood. Most evidence of how advanced these ancient civilizations actually were, which we've talked some about in recent weeks, were destroyed. It's not simply water erosion. Entire empires of Nephilim architecture and ancient angelic technology were just totally destroyed and wiped out. A world, a whole world, erased and all but forgotten for better or for worse, or not or, for better and for worse. And why do I say the days of Noah and that whole world being forgotten is for better and for worse? What's better and what's worse?
They have pure
Okay, so that was better. Okay, so there's good things that happened, obviously, as a result of the flood. But as far as it pertains to kind of having forgotten it, what's a bad thing as it pertains to having kind of totally forgotten that world? Okay, we have to reinvent the wheel in a sense, maybe. Yeah, well, and that was good. Let me reword this. I'm expressing myself on the worst part poorly. What could be a bad thing about most people not grasping the days of Noah now? Are there any common phrases that kind of go along with that? You two put your heads together. Okay, those who can't remember the past are condemned or doomed to repeat it. Is that a biblical concept, though? Certainly that's not a verse, but is it a biblical concept?
Yeah, that's a...
Yes. Just Israel. Yeah. Well, that's all you got to do. We certainly see... Go ahead, Ken. Okay, because of sin, we repeat our mistakes. We certainly see evidence where this has happened over and over again. And we see where God specifically commands remembrance as a big thing. He commands remembrance in a variety of different ways. Things like setting up these stones to kind of make this remembrance, or putting this under the Jordan, or feasts that you're to celebrate annually. There's a number of ways we could look into, and we're just not going to for the sake of time, how God calls us to remember. And that's something I think we miss. I think there's tons of legitimate Christian application here for us. It's something, just very briefly, I'll share with you that my wife has struggled with assurance of salvation for years. She kind of wavers. She feels real confident, and then that'll last for a year or two, and then she'll kind of waver and doubt because of just blowing it, like we all do. And then you kind of evaluate your works and you say, well, this isn't congruent with who I am. And so she and I had some fantastic time with one another and with God, and it seems that from her perspective, as she shares it, that God really facilitated an incredible spiritual breakthrough where she's really believes God's made it clear to her that she's His and belongs to Him and she's saved and on and on. And I've shared this with a couple of you just in the last couple of weeks. And so it was a really big deal. And so we try to commemorate it and celebrate it and enjoy God and rejoice with it, make it a celebration. You've heard me talk about celebrating. I don't think we do that well. We don't celebrate with God and enjoy Him and these types of things. But there's a remembrance piece to this where we make notes and, okay, here's what God did, or here's what I think God did, and here's kind of what He brought to mind, and I'm going to set that aside. So next time when I'm feeling doubtful, I'm going to go back to that and see what He did and kind of what He showed me and maybe verses that He led me to and on and on. I think this whole concept of remembrance is critical for all kinds of reasons, and certainly one piece of that would be when we don't remember, we repeat the mistakes of the past, and kind of as I think Tammy was getting at, we see that with Israel. If you just read through the Old Testament, I mean, you just see generation after generation after generation, the patience and the grace and the mercy of God as they do the same thing over and over and over and over. And we think, well, we wouldn't do that. We're the exact same. We do the same thing in different ways and to different degrees, but we still make the same mistakes and we still sin, and God is still gracious and merciful and patient with us. Praise God. So are these days, Ecclesiastes 1:9, Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun. So that's another biblical piece to this puzzle that we see this kind of, there's nothing new, it just keeps recycling. So are these days that we're talking about here, the days of Noah that are not vastly understood, are these days going to repeat? Is history going to repeat itself? You think so? Why?
All these warnings that see the repeat of
All these warnings, we're going to see the repeat. I'm hearing you answer it. Go ahead, behind you. I think I'm hearing you. Susan? What you were saying was right. I tell you, with these new ceilings, it doesn't matter if you whisper. It carries across these ceilings. It's incredible. I think I heard you say, as in the days of Noah, and so it will be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man, which we talked about at the very beginning today, and that's exactly right. It will repeat. Jesus has said it will. Authoritatively, it's going to happen. And people reject the truth. We covered back maybe week two, week three, that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. I mean, he heralded the truth, and they just ignored him. I mean, they did not hear it. They did not receive it. They just kept going on about their business, exactly what you're talking about. Absolutely. Number four here. This is a very quick one. The Garden of Eden was destroyed. Now, that's obvious, but it's often overlooked. Previously, man was banished from this special garden that God himself planted. It's a place where God's presence was unique, and God placed a cherubim and a flaming sword to guard the entrance to it and to the tree of life. We don't have time to dive down this, but that was not just to keep Adam and Eve out, that was also to keep Satan and his forces out. Angels, fallen angels, were not accessing the tree of life. Number five. So we've covered a number of things that happened. What happened with fallen angels as a result of the flood, in the flood, during the flood? What happened to fallen angels? Okay, more than that. They were chained up. Okay, so let's because both of you are right, so let's be more specific. She says they're still here. She says they're chained up. And I'm saying both of you are right, so explain it in a way that makes that work. Say it again. The Nephilim is the word you're saying, but no, the ones that sinned with women and then created the Nephilim.
Yeah, they got chained up.
Okay, they got chained up, which was only some small percentage, presumably, of the total fallen angel force. Richard?
From my perspective, fallen angels that have relationships with women.
Yes, they are. Don't get ahead of me. Okay. Okay, and we're going to tackle that in just a minute. Yes, but what we're told is the angels who sinned, we're not told that all the angels sinned with the women. So there are, and we that was back in week two, I think, where we saw that certainly Satan is a fallen angel, and he is present, roaring around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Prowling around, rather, and we also saw Paul allude to these classes of angels that are our enemies actively now. So a portion of them, as Edith was saying, engaged in the sexual relations, the forbidden relations with human women, and they are bound in chains. They were cast into the bottomless pit or Tartarus, and then the rest of them are still around. Steve. Okay, Antarctica. I'm not going to open that can of worms. But yeah, Enoch does, but also the Bible does, and so we don't have to rely on Enoch. Does anybody remember where the Bible tells us that they're chained, that they're locked in gloomy darkness, eternal chains, the bottomless pit? The Bible tells us this. Genesis 2? No. It's in the New Testament. Second Peter chapter 2, 4 through 6. Okay, and the other reference is? That one does address them down there, but doesn't address them being chained up down there. There's one other. Starts with a J. Ends with Ood. Paul's right. Jude. So 2 Peter 2 and Jude, obviously there's only one chapter in Jude, tell us clearly. So Jude chapter 1 verse 6 says, "And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority," again, we're talking about the angels, not the Nephilim here, "the angels who did not stay within their position of authority but left their proper dwelling or their proper abode, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day." And then 2 Peter 2:4 says, "For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment," and then it continues on. So the angels who sinned specifically are in chains in the bottomless pit, locked up. They're not going anywhere. They're there right now. At least they're not going anywhere until the... Do what? The timing of the incarceration?
Yes.
You can't say this is exactly when it happened, but I'm going to talk a little more about this next week when we get into the different ways that they could have returned, and I'll go ahead and preview a little bit to help answer the question, because one of the ways, and we've already talked about this, I think 2 weeks ago, I think I previewed again just because Richard was hammering me, one of the ways is that's believed that they could have returned is that fallen angels just fell again. And so later, or not fell again, sinned again. So another group did the same thing again. I'm going to share some of why I don't think that's true or why that didn't happen. But some take that perspective. And then you get all kinds of stuff like this seems to be referring to one group of angels. There's no distinction of like different groups at different times. It seems that they sinned, and then their sin is specifically tied to Noah. It says in the days of Noah when they were doing this sinning, and then they were locked up. It doesn't say that they were locked up the same day, but we would have to... That seems to me like the most logical reading of it versus saying, well, let's interject some period of years or centuries before God punished. Yes, the bottomless pit is a part of hell. It's an area of hell, and the fallen angels who sinned in the procreating with human women to create the Nephilim, which was only a small percentage of the total fallen angels, those are locked up in hell,
so
Tartarus.
Those people that are angels that are locked up are not considered part of the living creatures that we sent all were.
Well, angels are not and that's part of the point of this conversation too, is angels are not, they're spirit entities, they're spirit beings. You can't drown an angel. So angels were not killed, angels are not going to ever be killed. They're going to exist. Go ahead, Sandy.
So, the fallen angels are not locked up.
Uh-huh.
If they're on the earth,
they can maneuver around different abodes or dwellings, namely dimensions and stuff like that. Well, it's not that some survived and some didn't. All angels survived. So the flood, the goal of the flood was not to drown or destroy angels. It was one of the goals of the flood was to drown and destroy the Nephilim. And then God incarcerated the angels. The flood didn't really have anything to do with that. But there's another perspective that talks about their physical body, because they do have bodies. Angels do have bodies. They're just able to shapeshift, in a sense. They can manifest themselves in different ways. We saw Satan manifest himself as a serpent. It would make him look like an animal. We see him, we're told he manifests himself as an angel of light. Virtually all the interactions that we see between humans and angels, the angels are described as men. And so they look like humans. So they do have a body, and there's kind of two different directions, I guess, on that. One is that, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. One is that that the flood swept the fallen angels into the abyss. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. The other is that it doesn't really, I mean, the flood could not destroy them. They could escape in whatever ways they wanted to from the water, but God himself locked them up. I mean, they're not getting away from God. Either way, the bottom line is the conclusion that we've come to, where there's this small percentage locked up, and then the rest of them are not locked up. A little more on this in just a minute. Any other questions before we press on the same point? I'm not leaving this point. I'm just going to expand on it more. Quentin? Yes, ma'am. Well, we can argue whether or not that's happened yet or not. I would say that's not happened yet. But why did he cast him? Well, it specifically tells us in Revelation to he comes after the saints. For sure, God's going to use Satan to accomplish his holy purposes in the tribulation time, and even now he's still doing it, just in a different kind of way. Then it will be a more literal, physical presence in the end. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's really a whole counsel of God question, like saying, what's the purpose of Satan's existence? Well, that's a few different Bible studies, but certainly God is ruling sovereignly over him. And Satan, even though his desire is to harm the people of God, he is made in his very desires to harm the people of God. He's made to serve God and God's purposes, God's good and holy purposes for the people of God, even when it doesn't feel like that temporarily or physically in this life. Because we know that all things work together for what? Good of who? Good for who? Those who love God and are called by him. So this is specifically all things work together for the good of the elect, even Satan and sin and sickness and cancer and all kinds of sabotage and fallen angels and Nephilim and on and on and on. It all works together for the good of the elect, even when we're, like Elaine, totally miserable and cannot see it in this life. But in the next life, we will. We see through a mirror dimly now, but we'll see in full then. Praise God. Yeah, they still retained access to heavenly realms. They still retained access to God himself. Right. They weren't. And not all, it would be presumptuous of us to say all angels that fell were physically present on the earth during the antediluvian era. I think that would be presumptuous, but yeah, we'll definitely cover how they returned. I say definitely. At this rate, we'll start to cover how they returned next week. But I don't think we'll get through all three pieces. I think it's just simply interesting. If you're a note taker, you could write down Job 4, 18. He tells us there that God, quote, charged his angels with folly. I'm not going to read a bunch of references, but folly, quote unquote, folly, the word translated folly is most often used to describe sexual sin. And so this is specifically referring to the angels that he did charge with folly, not all angels, but these fallen ones who committed this sexual sin. It just kind of fits into this conversation. So he judged them and then he incarcerated them. We've already talked about the passages here. I was going to reread those, but we've covered them. So, as it pertains to fallen angels and the antediluvian world, these angels interacted with humans openly. In some limited sense, it appears that heaven prematurely came to earth in some sense. They were literally and physically present, engaging and interacting with people as themselves. And remember, they were godlike and they were treated by humanity as such. However, post-flood, their dealings with humanity changes. Their interactions and dealings with humanity are curbed quite significantly. They're still around, and this would apply, we would say, okay, how's it different right now for us than what it was in the days of Noah? They're still around, and they're still extremely powerful, and they still lead the whole world, except for God's chosen people, under the control and under the influence of the evil one, the god of this age, the prince of the power of the air, and much more. Yes.
They were spiritual beings with fleshly bodies.
But again, I don't want to say, kind of like I was saying to Sandy, it would be presumptuous to say all did. But certainly they did have bodies. They do have bodies. They're created with bodies. But they manifested themselves with physical bodies on the earth. I don't think so, because we see physical bodies, or allusion at least to physical body and spiritual warfare later on, even before the time of Christ in the Old Testament. But we're going to see there's a big difference, and I don't think we'll have time to even get to it today, but there's a big difference between angels, which have a physical body, and demons who don't, which Richard got at. And so those are spirit entities that don't have a body, and we're going to spend quite some time on that because I think that's real important. So they're still present, they're still powerful, they're still the focus of our spiritual warfare, but they're not in this room with us, physically talking to us, engaging with us like they did before the flood. Something changed. God did something. He limited them in some capacity. The dynamics are different. When Jude said the sinning angels left their proper abode or their proper dwelling, that abode or dwelling refers to a dimension. It's their natural habitation. It's where they exist. Spiritual realm, heavenly realms is what that's talking about. They left that. It would appear that while the fallen angels still have significant access today and have since the flood, that they still have significant access to and influence on the earth, they kept their proper abode until the end times when Satan is physically cast to the earth, like somebody was talking about, out of his proper abode to make war on the saints. And so the angels are still around, fallen angels are still around, they're still powerful, they're still influencing, they're just operating in the heavenly realms, not physically here. Steve? You're getting ahead of me. No, you're good. Yes. Particle accelerator, CERN, all that stuff. I'm actually going to talk about those next week at this rate. For sure next week. We got 10 minutes, so or 15 minutes. But let's see here. I will introduce this point. I plan to spend at least half an hour on this point. And so I'm going to introduce this point and then not go too far with it. And then we'll call it a day. So we've covered kind of five things so far. And I told you I had six that I want to cover, what happened during the flood as a result of the flood. So number six is kind of circling back to the destruction of all flesh, but it's more specific now. Namely, it destroyed the Nephilim, right? All the Nephilim were destroyed. You don't sound certain. You sound like you think it's a trick question. I wouldn't do that. You're right. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't trick you. So what then? What Nephilim gets wiped out. What happens to their spirits? Richard can't answer. Come again? You're right. I still didn't hear. Did you say they don't have one? Or you? Do they? Well, we covered last week where they got their spirit and their spirit nature from. Namely, they got it from it comes from the Father's side. It came from the fallen angels. That's why they were uniquely corrupt, because it came from this angelic, fallen angelic being mixing with humans. So, yes, they have a spirit. We'll prove that more next week. What happened to their spirits? Where does your spirit go if you die? Heaven or hell? Okay, so it's not a trick question yet. Their spirits, they either go, just like ours, they either go to heaven or to hell now, then. At the time, their spirits went. I said, no, Richards. No, you go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Which that, that's a,
an indication that they are looking for habitation.
Yes. So back then, when the flood happened, what happened to their spirits? They went to Hades, just like every other non-believing, unsaved person would have gone. They go to the wicked side of Sheol, like every other person who's ever died apart from Christ back then. Now, I realize in saying that one sentence, if you're paying attention, that it opens up an entire conversation about Sheol and the abode of the dead and Abraham's bosom and much more. And while you know me, I have lots to say about most things. I have lots to say on that, Sheol and the abode of the dead and all that good stuff. We're going to bypass that entirely. If it's something of significant interest, maybe we can come back to it later. That's kind of pre and post Christ and all that kind of stuff. But I want to bypass that conversation for now and deal specifically with the spirits of the Nephilim that went there. What do we know about these guys? What are the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim? You're allowed to answer now.
Are they the demons?
They are demons. This right here is the origin story of all demons and demonic activity on the earth. Right here, the flood. Now, this is a major assertion from the book of Enoch and the Bible. We'll get to that. But let me just read a paragraph. We read the first part of this paragraph, so this is five verses. We've already read the first three, and I'll add to it two more verses that just gives us even more. This is Enoch chapter 15, verses 8 through 12. And now the giant, and again, this is not, we don't want to hang on this. We're going to hang on the word after this, but I just want to, this is just adding a little context. It says, and now the giants who are produced from the spirits and flesh shall be called evil spirits upon the earth, and on the earth shall be their dwelling. Evil spirits have proceeded from their bodies, because they are born from men and from the holy watchers, which is their beginning and primal origin. They shall be evil spirits on the earth, and evil spirits they shall be called. As for the spirits of heaven, in heaven shall be their dwelling, but as for the spirits of the earth, which were born upon the earth, on the earth shall be their dwelling. And the spirits of the giants afflict, oppress, destroy, attack, do battle, and work destruction on the earth and cause trouble. They take no food, but nevertheless hunger and thirst and cause offenses. And these spirits shall rise up against the children of men and against women, because they have proceeded from them. Now, ultimately, we're not real concerned with what extra-biblical texts have to offer unless they're confirmed by the Bible. So the question is, and we'll be spending more time on this next week, is does the Bible support this claim? Namely, that demons are the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. And I believe the answer is yes, but to get there, we're gonna go through a number of things and kind of talk about demons. We're going to do a fairly light study on demons and kind of deal with them, obviously their origin story, how they're different from angels, what they do. We're going to see some interactions in the Old Testament, in Jesus' earthly ministry, and we're going to look ahead even to some role that these disembodied spirits play even in the very end of the end times. And so they're around, they're pervasive, they're used by God. So I don't know when else we would do a study like this, kind of lightly deal with demons. I don't think I'll ever preach on something like this. It's too non-essential to warrant a significant chunk of our essential time. So that's kind of where we're headed, at least at the beginning of class next week. And let me see if I want to give you more preview. Some differences between them, kind of what happened to them. I will preview that I don't believe Enoch seems to lean in the direction of that all disembodied spirits of Nephilim are here, like they're trapped here. But I don't believe the Bible supports that. The Bible teaches, and we'll unpack this next week, that they went to hell and that some of them are then able to come back out of hell onto the earth, and we're going to get into that, but the earth is not roaming with billions of disembodied Nephilim giant spirits, or else their involvement would be a lot more center stage and pervasive than it is now. Rather, there are some, quite significant, thousands and thousands, but not billions or hundreds of millions, whatever the number was at the time of the flood. So there are, I think the Book of Enoch is wrong in that context, but it does give us a little bit of insight into what was going on. Questions or comments before we move toward wrapping it up? Where I'm headed is this stuff about demons, more on demons, how they come up out of hell, demon possession, whether or not Christians can be, a little more about demons, and then the return of the Nephilim. So that's kind of the direction we're headed. There you are. Yes, yes. I would word it slightly different, but yes, yes. Yes, they created a being, a whole new race, a whole new species that did have a spirit that came from their spiritual nature of their father. And then when their bodies, physical bodies are destroyed, because it wiped out all the Nephilim, not wiped out their physical bodies, their spirits, just like you and me, continue to live on. And most of them live on in hell, and some of them live on the earth, and some of them go back and forth, and we see biblical evidence of that that we'll unpack next week. Demon possession. Demons are the spirits. The disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. So we got to keep remembering, because it's really easy to get confused here. Nephilim are not fallen angels. Fallen angels are created by God. They are they have a body. They have a spirit. They a third fell, and then they create some of those had these relations with women and created this whole new species. And so there's this. Angels and Nephilim, and the demons, the disembodied spirits, are of the Nephilim. They are the Nephilim. They're just their spirits. You know, their nature and that sort of thing still lives on through their spirits, and we see that all over the place, especially at a heightened time during the time of Christ, during his earthly ministry, which is somewhat intriguing. Preview. Since we have three more minutes, are there any... I've wanted to ask this for several weeks now. Are there any, when we finish kind of talking about demons here, we're going to be done with the antediluvian era, and we're going to be moving post that way, going to see stuff after the flood and leading in toward application to the end times and all that kind of stuff. Are there any questions that you have, first of all, as it pertains to the antediluvian era, and second of all, just with this class in general that you'd like to see answered? I'm not going to answer them now, but if you have questions, you can share them with me, and I can perhaps see to it that we cover them. Is there any burning questions or something that you wish we had covered that we haven't, or anything like that? People being saved. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, we talked about this on Sunday. That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. So you want to talk about irredeemability. We've already covered some of that, but we can cover it again, specifically as it pertains to... test tube babies.
Yeah, when they spoke to Nicodemus, it was brought that people want to be born of water.
And for sure, we're headed toward a lot of the practical application for the times we're in now, and the times we're headed is the whole transhumanism stuff. merging with AI and DNA manipulation that'll be happening, and reemergence of Nephilim and ways that that could happen and will happen and stuff like that. So we'll be getting into all that for sure. Okay, well, they're not demons, but they could be possessed by demons. They could be being influenced from the outside and tempted and deceived by demons or fallen angels, for that matter. And I don't think it's limited to the United States. I think it's the whole world for the most part. But Sandy, fallen angels, I'm hesitant to say that dogmatically, but we've seen them take a variety of forms, and we know they can, in a sense, shapeshift. Right. Theoretically could be. It appears, though, at least until the time of the end, where their Satan and presumably his forces are physically cast out of their abode into the earthly realm, it appears that they're in their own abode, not able to do that right now. So they're not wandering around. We don't have some infiltrators in this room who are fallen angels, but they're influencing in other less direct ways, sometimes even in direct ways, but just not the same, physically speaking, as it was pre-flood. And then you get the whole Revelation chapter 12, when he's cast out of heaven, and when that happened is debated, and that sort of thing. But I, like I covered with the fallen angels, I think it's not the same. I would not affirm that we've got a bunch of fallen angels walking around that look like people. But again, I don't want to be too dogmatic. Yes, you can host angels and treat angels as you've treated them. That's how we've Christ says you treated me as you treated the least of them, and you can host them unaware, like you're saying. Yeah. So there's a sense in which they can break in. And those are specifically talking about angels of light. But again, that's why I'm telling Sandy, I want to be real careful and not be too dogmatic and try to kind of infer to the best of our ability, but be as humble and gracious as I can here. And this stuff is non-essential. It's non-essential. And we're going to, if you say, well, no, it's not, because if there are a bunch of fallen angels wandering around, there's all kinds of implications. And I'm saying, settle down, take a deep breath. We're going to talk about assurance and security, which needs to be talked about, and how God, I think Richard made reference to this, how we're protected by God from these sorts of things. If we're born again, the Holy Spirit protects us. He's sealed us. He's going to see us through all the way to the end. So there's incredible security. There does not need to be fear. We're not given a spirit of fear. We're given the Spirit. So lots more on that. We will certainly kind of end this study on that note, on the security, the assurance, and the protection that God's going to guarantee, has already guaranteed, and will see us through the end, regardless of how incredibly deceiving it may be, or how wicked it may be, or how, I'll leave it at that. We'll get into more specifics later. We're about 2 minutes late, so if somebody's got one final anything, if not, we will pray. Okay.
That I'd like to add to the list of things to address in the
future
is the idea of aliens, the deception that comes with that.
Yes, we're definitely going to cover aliens, UFOs, all that kind of stuff. Official disclosure.
Noah's daughter's in-laws.
Yes, we're going to talk about that probably not next week, but the week after. Since we got about halfway where I thought we would get today, so I think we will get the rest of this done next week, plus we'll get started on how the Nephilim return. There's three main ways, and we'll spend most of our time on number three, and so we'll definitely get through number one, and we might get to touch number two next week. So this will be fun stuff. This is important. So come back. Tammy, would you mind closing us in a word of prayer?
Fellowship with each other, to fellowship with you. We just thank you for your
Amen.